ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, I'm Dominique Bayens, host of a new podcast I'm super excited to share with you. It's called Expanse, the NANUP 4, about the mysterious vanishing of four people 2 decades ago and their world of cults and hidden identities. Stick around after this episode of If You're Listening to hear a teaser of what you can expect when episode 1 drops on March 3rd.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. Well, it's been an interesting weekend.
A short time ago, the United States military began major combat operations in Iran.
The Israeli-US joint strikes began in broad daylight, hitting multiple Iranian cities, including the capital. In Iran, people celebrated near the Ayatollah's destroyed compound as news spread of the 86-year-old dictator's death from Israeli and US bombs.
The strikes have been met with fierce retaliation from the regime, launching missiles and drones at countries across the Middle East.
Yeah, a bit going on. It's, ironically, perfect timing for us. We've just completed our 3 episodes on Jeffrey Epstein, and we're intending to do a number of episodes on Iran. And Donald Trump delivered an extraordinary amount of information on our doorstep that we are going to be filtering into an Iran series that will be rolling out from Thursday here on the podcast and on Saturday on YouTube and TV. There's a lot to talk about, and Cara Jensen-McKinnon is here with me. G'day, Cara.
Hello. We've got a lot to say.
Yes, I've got a lot of hot takes, but I want to hear first from you, where were you when your phone started blowing up with this information?
Oh, my God. So I was in a great space because I was in the mosh at the Sydney Olympic Park for Bad Bunny.
Nice.
Who was performing on Saturday night. So I was right in the middle. A lot of people around me, I'm trying to get a good spot, vying for a perfect position. My phone starts buzzing, and I'm thinking it's people commenting on videos that I'm posting, but it's actually several notifications coming through from The Guardian, from Reuters, from New York Times, from BBC, all of the subscriptions that I have, telling me that Israel and then the United States have launched a coordinated bombing campaign on Iran.
We begin with breaking news this evening. Israel has launched airstrikes against Iran.
Absolutely not the sort of thing that you want to hear when you're trying to get into the zone for Bad Bunny.
Not really Bad Bunny's vibe.
It's not really Bad Bunny's vibe. I started messaging you. My phone reception was way down because obviously everyone's uploading things to Instagram. A couple of hours later, I get more notifications saying that Iran has launched retaliation strikes and that they had hit a building in Tel Aviv and several military bases. Again, I'm like jostling and trying to look at my phone at the same, trying to kind of manage and keep the vibe up, but also looking at extremely serious news happening and really, really not being able to do anything about it. I didn't have my laptop in the mosh, you'd be surprised to hear, but I really just had to enjoy the Bad Bunny mosh, knowing that that was going to be what the next couple of days would look like for me.
At concerts these days, of course, you have to watch the performance through a sea of phones being held up.
Exactly.
So everybody else around you is holding up their phones to film Bad Bunny, and you're holding up your phone to monitor the situation.
Exactly. I was very much the monitoring the situation meme over the entire weekend.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there's a lot to unpack. So we put out a call for questions, basically, and we've got in just a few hours a lot of very great questions from online. So we wanted to get through some of those today.
Yes.
First of which is from Paul on X. He asks, could Iran disintegrate into ethnic factions now, like Iraq, if the regime falls?
That's a very good question, Paul. And yes, absolutely it could. In fact, there's more risk really of that happening in Iran than almost any other country. And I'll show you why this is, Cara, because I'm going to send you two maps.
You know, I'm famously very good at reading maps. So this is this is good.
One of them is a topographic map, and one of them is a map of Iranian language groups.
Okay, so I'm looking at the topographic map. It's just showing me that there's a whole lot of mountain ranges that are all throughout Iran, so it's very mountainous.
It's kind of a ring around the edges of Iran. You can also see that there's a central plateau of flatness. That's where the big population centers are. It's Iran and Isfahan and the big cities up on that central desert plateau. But the other important thing that you can see is that there's lots of sort of very low-lying flat land.
Yes.
Around those mountains. So on the shore of the Persian Gulf, on the shore of the Arabian Sea, on the shore of the Caspian Sea. So now look at the language map.
Well, I mean, the vast majority of Iran are Persians.
Yes, and that is the central desert plateau area.
Yes.
Where Tehran, Isfahan, the big cities are.
I mean, and then we've just got a whole range of language groups kind of surrounding that.
Yeah, there's enormous language and ethnic diversity in the mountain ring.
Yes.
Around the edge of Iran. And you see that Iran borders a whole bunch of countries, and you can see that there's a lot of influence of those surrounding countries coming up into those low-lying flatlands around the coasts and into the mountains. So in the case of instability from particularly the central government in Tehran, it's very likely that some of these ethnic groups around the edges are going to decide, you know what, we'd rather be either independent or we'd rather be more closer to other people from our ethnic and language group. We Azeris would like to be independent or part of Azerbaijan, or we Turkmens would like to have more to do with Turkmenistan than Tehran.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things that the Iranian regime has been most terrified of really since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. They've been doing so much work to try and keep all those ethnic groups united and subjugated under their control.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that they need to do that is those mountain areas and those flat areas are where all the water and oil is.
Very important for their economy.
Yes, the two things that make the country run.
Yes.
But yeah, no, that is definitely something that the regime will be acting as quickly as possible to try and defend itself against. They're more at risk of this than almost any other country in the region because of the incredible ethnic diversity they have around the edges of the country.
We've got a couple of questions coming in about which group or who is likely to fill the power vacuum in the next coming days and weeks. One question from Chris is it possible the Crown Prince could return as the first elected non-hereditary monarch with elections to select future heads of state as opposed to president of a republic?
Okay. Could the Crown Prince return as the leader of an Iran after a regime collapse caused by these strikes and the death of the supreme leader? The answer is kind of two parts. One is the regime going to collapse in the first place? I don't think that's at all assured. The regime isn't as singularly focused on a single person as some other regimes around the world are. Like the Ayatollah Khamenei isn't kind of like Vladimir Putin or Saddam Hussein or any of these guys for whom if you get rid of that person, then really the regime will sort of collapse around them. There's enormous bureaucracy around the Iranian regime, and there is also an enormous armed revolutionary guard, which is designed to protect the regime and has a lot of incentives to do so. There's a lot of people. We're talking hundreds of thousands, even millions of people with a vested stake in the regime remaining in power, and they're the ones with the guns. They do have sort of people around who can take up positions of people who have been killed by American and Israeli airstrikes. So potentially the regime survives. But let's go into the hypothetical with Chris's question and look at could, if the regime doesn't survive, the Crown Prince, Reza Pahlavi, who is the son of the Shah of Iran, who was deposed in 1979 as part of the Iranian Islamic Revolution and died soon afterwards, His son, who was 20 at the time of the revolution, is now 62 and is a bit of a favourite of Western media and has been doing a lot of Western media interviews whereby he sort of talks about potentially being available to lead some sort of a transition to democracy in Iran. He's a person that does have some level of popularity in Iran itself. It's difficult to tell in a closed system like Iran how much support he really has.
Hmm.
But I wonder whether he's a bit more like Alexei Navalny or a Juan Guaido figure, where the Westerners like to portray him as a legitimate opposition leader. But inside the country that he's exiled from, he's not as much of a popular figure. A lot of people obviously don't like the regime of the Ayatollahs.
Yes.
But a lot of people really didn't like the Shah either.
No. Famously.
If the regime was to collapse, a lot of people would be like, can't we have something that isn't either of those things?
Yes.
And I think the Americans have very much decided that they're sick of trying to find people to install in the regimes they topple. Donald Trump has made it pretty clear that he's happy with whoever rises out of the disappearance of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela.
Mm.
He's allowed Maduro's vice president to take over and is negotiating with her as though she is the new legitimate president of Venezuela. He's not trying to install Maria Corina Machado, the Venezuelan opposition leader who is living in exile and gave her Nobel Peace Prize to him.
Mm.
He's happy with just not Nicolas Maduro. So
yeah.
Whether the United States, if the regime was to fall, would be like, all right, and here's your new guy. It's the crown prince. I don't know that they necessarily would do that.
Exactly. I think when we've seen this happen in the past in the region, if you think about Afghanistan when the Taliban was toppled or with Iraq when it was Saddam Hussein, there was at least some kind of semblance of nation-building aspirations from the US that they would kind of try and do their best to install some sort of leader or some sort of kind of infrastructure that would help the people, whereas I feel like this time it feels more similar to the removal of Gaddafi in Libya in 2011, where the country basically shortly descended into a civil war that is ongoing. There was never really any resolve. And so I think there are a lot of people who are concerned that Trump really doesn't have any long-term plans for this and that he's just started a situation that will result in a prolonged civil war and also millions of refugees, you know, and the country is already enduring water shortages. They've already got economic issues. You know, they're going through so much already that this will be catastrophic kind of regardless of what happens.
Well, Kara, you're predicting the future. Didn't we just do a whole series about not predicting
the
future?
Sorry.
No, I think you're right in saying that ingredients are certainly there for chaos to break out.
Yes, absolutely.
You have an already angry, impoverished, frustrated population.
Yes.
Alongside a regime that has shown they are extremely willing to shoot their own citizens if they cause any problems. We're going to be talking about that in our series. Just weeks ago, we saw thousands of people killed in the streets of Tehran by the Revolutionary Guards in an attempt to put down any sort of challenge to the regime at the time. The regime will feel even more cornered now than they were before.
Mm.
They will be more terrified of collapsing, and that is unlikely to make them more peaceful. So I think the ingredients are there, but obviously we don't predict the future on this show.
That's right.
We talk about hypotheticals. We don't predict the future.
Okay. Our next question is from Bob Harris on Blue Sky. He asks, is there one historical case where outside decapitation of a leadership has led to democracy?
Well, that's a good question, Bob, but I would refer you to our back catalogue because we kind of did an episode about the precedent that a lot of these American war planners look at, which is Panama. There was a straight decapitation of the Panamanian dictator, Manuel Noriega, and Panama pretty rapidly became quite a successful, by regional standards, country with a functioning democracy and competitive elections and free press and all the great things that the Americans say they want everybody to have. The problem is that, like, that was more of the exception than the rule. I think Donald Trump is sort of hoping that that's what's going to end up happening in Venezuela, but he's made it very clear that he doesn't want to be involved in that kind of thing. Donald Trump's involvement in these things, he's made it pretty clear, is limited to things that can be delivered by fighter jets and attack helicopters.
Mm.
He will happily drop missiles and drone strikes, and he will send in commandos for very limited strikes or kidnapping operations, but he is not interested in long-term involvement in these wars.
I mean, he's also just said recently that his intention is for this to go for 4 to 5 weeks.
Yeah.
Which famously isn't a very long period of time to establish a entirely new democratic system in a country. So,
oh, yeah. Well, he's definitely not going to try and establish a democratic system. No.
No, exactly.
He's hoping to bomb enough of the existing system that it collapses on its own.
There's obviously also the other modern cases after World War II, Germany, Japan, and Italy. The differences there would be that they were absolutely devastated by the war, economically, militarily. They unconditionally surrendered. They also started the war in the first place, and they had very recently been functioning democracies in the past.
Germany and Italy had been.
So they had kind of the democratic literacy for how that system worked. So it wasn't like you needed to bring in and shift an entire way of thinking for an entire population. So they had democratic infrastructure in place. They already had all of the democratic understanding. And so to revert back to that system with a different leader wasn't as much of an ask as it would be for, say, a country that is not democratic at all.
Well, on top of that, Germany and Japan were under military occupation by the United States and its allies for many years afterwards.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
Still retain massive military presence by the United States Army in both of those countries. The United States is still there 81 years after the end of World War II, making sure that there's no problems.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump is, I don't think, I did watch the speech with the baseball cap on and the speech without the baseball cap on, and I don't recall that he's planning on having a military involvement in Iran for the next 81 years.
Our next question is, why have Anthony Albanese and Mark Carney suddenly decided to side with Trump?
We support the United States acting to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and to prevent Iran from continuing to threaten international peace and security.
Our colleague Patricia Carvelis has an interesting take on this, which is basically that they are being very specific about their support.
Mm.
They are saying that their support is specifically about making sure that Iran doesn't have the ability to make a nuclear bomb. They haven't come out to say, you know, we support the attempt to topple the Iranian regime.
Mm.
They have said that we support the idea of ensuring global security and ensuring the continuation of the rules-based international order by making sure that Iran can't have any nuclear weapons. Mark Carney in particular has made it clear that he is a big proponent of trying to hold some semblance of the rules-based international order together.
Yeah.
Through this era where international norms are being shredded, he's trying to hold alliances together and he's trying to find areas where he and the United States can agree. But if this turns into a broader regime change effort over weeks, months, years, it will be interesting to see how they respond to that. Mark Carney is going to be in Australia this week. And I imagine that he's going to get quite a number of questions about his and Anthony Albanese's decision to conditionally support what Donald Trump has done with Benjamin Netanyahu as well.
And that leads nicely to the next question, which is, if the US can assault Iran like this, what is stopping China from bombing Taiwan whenever they feel like it? That's really the point of kind of upholding rules-based order, is basically that not a whole lot. You know, you would hope that there would be more stopping him, but there doesn't seem to be a lot. So, yeah, that is a big concern because there are other regions. There's Greenland, there's Cuba, there's Mexico that he has been eyeing off, you know, Canada obviously being one. where if you set a precedent that you can bomb a country because you disagree with the leadership of that country, then we're entering very dangerous and murky territory.
I think the one thing that you could say to push back on that is that Taiwan is a far better functioning, far more cohesive society than either Venezuela or Iran.
Absolutely.
We're not seeing regime on the verge of collapse in Taiwan. We're seeing a functioning democracy with, you know, a functioning and well-equipped military and functioning well-equipped civil institutions and a populace that is generally quite supportive of the government and of their current status, of their status quo. I didn't say independence there, but their status quo, their current ability to govern themselves.
Mm.
Certainly those things will make doing anything similar to Taiwan far more, far, far, far more complicated. Taiwan also theoretically has a lot more international support than Iran and Venezuela, both of whom were kind of regional pariahs.
Yeah.
If China was to attack Taiwan, they would certainly see a response from Japan and Korea and possibly the Philippines, and they would potentially see a response from the United States and US allies, which is a much bigger threat than the US apparently faces. There's certainly some finger-wagging going on, but in terms of the region, Iran has made the extraordinary decision to respond to being under attack by attacking US bases in the surrounding area in countries that didn't necessarily support America's decision to attack Iran, now has given, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, a lot of reason to really not like the regime in Iran.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an interesting thing to see who, if anybody, comes to Iran's aid.
We've got one final question. Trump has stated America's involvement could last 1 month, given he said he could stop the Russian-Ukraine conflict in 1 day. Do you believe him? And what does our government do if he asks for our help?
Well, that last part is very much something that I imagine that the Australian government is just really crossing their fingers that they don't have to answer.
Absolutely.
Australia certainly has a history of helping the United States into things, but I would say that Donald Trump isn't the sort of person that asks for help. You've got to remember that when Australia has followed the United States into these conflicts, we have been asked to. The United States was seeking a global coalition to go into Vietnam or go into Iraq or go into Afghanistan. They were asking for help. Donald Trump is very clear that it's America first and I don't need anybody's help. Thank you very much.
Mm.
So it's not as though Donald Trump is potentially looking for assistance in the same way as George W. Bush or Richard Nixon or Johnson or Bill Clinton. All of them wanted us to join in. I don't know that Donald Trump cares.
Yeah.
As for whether we trust him that it can last for a month, well, that is certainly what he thinks.
Yeah.
And that is going to be the subject of our episode coming up on Thursday, where we're going to be looking at why Donald Trump thinks that he can contain conflicts this size in a way that no other US president has ever managed to be able to do. So that is what we're going to be talking about on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give you a full-length episode all about that.
Looking forward to it.
I better go write it. Thanks, Cara.
Thank you. Bye.
In the country, it's unusual to give away your chickens.
It's definitely going to raise eyebrows. Everyone in rural Australia knows you just don't give away laying chickens. So 2 decades ago, when a family on the outskirts of an isolated town called Nanup in Western Australia started getting rid of things.
And she's saying to Chantel, are you sure that you want to let go of these things?
People started noticing.
And Chantel said, yes, Leela's not going to need them anymore.
Daddy, stop doing that fight.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I live and work about 45 minutes away from the little blue farmhouse where those 4 people lived and disappeared from.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Chantelle and Leila McDougall, Tony Popich and Simon Cadwell vanished in July 2007.
Hey, somebody do the castanets. I'm feeling all Latin now.
They left behind a note saying they'd gone to Brazil and rumours of a dark online cult swirling in their absence. They were never conclusively seen again.
They have not accessed their bank accounts or travelled overseas on their passports.
What began as a missing persons case morphed into an international investigation as evidence of secrets, hidden identities and a mysterious cult leader emerged.
He was working the room. It was like a car salesman trying to sell you a bomb.
Something wasn't right.
Outlandish theories became distinct possibilities.
He told someone online that he was planning a family suicide pact, but later changed his mind.
I always thought that was their grand plan, to go to South America. This is where I have to take a deep breath here with stuff, because, yeah.
Why didn't we see any signs?
For months, I've been picking at the threads of this story to find out who the Nanup 4 were and what led them down the rabbit hole and into the face of disaster. And the further I've got, the more I've realised nothing is what it seems in this story.
I'm a non-gossip person, but it's very easy to hear lots of gossip.
Check that out.
He said, Chantelle's got end time syndrome.
Oh boy, he's weird.
Thought. To me, it was off the planet. It's
very strange.
My son's going, what is going on?
That's what happens when you cheat, see?
Namaste. I was starting to think this is not going to end well.
There are so many people left behind looking for answers, all the while trying to face two stark possibilities. Was the disappearance a choice or was it murder?
Turns out he wasn't trying to hurt them.
Beat them all.
He was actually trying to warn them.
All trying to work out how to live with the choices they made or didn't make that led them here.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what.
I'll regret it till the day I die.
I'm Dominique Baines.
I didn't want to lose her.
I can't change the past.
And this is season 6 of Expanse, the Nanup 4.
You've got two choices, be strong or be weak.
Subscribe to Expanse to hear the whole story.